seeking safety in the United States and instead winding up in detention.
I was kept in the cell in JFK for about 4 hours. They brought me out, put me in chains, threw me in a bus.
What can happen when an asylum seeker gets released?
I've heard cases of people walking 6-7 miles to find a homeless shelter. I heard about a woman who tried to go back into the detention center in order to sleep because she didn't know where else to go.
The long process of asylum and the difficult road once it's granted. Also, Beyoncé's Coachella performance captivated social media and helped one mom see why her daughter admires the singer so much.
The rest of the Black pioneers loosened the jar for Beyoncé to pop it open, and that's what she did.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, April 23rd, 2018.
The process of getting asylum has become more difficult each and every day.
Asylum in America is supposed to be a protection for people escaping danger in their home country. Adafe Okporo from Nigeria is one of them. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stories of refugees have dominated the headlines over the last year, but we hear a lot less about asylum seekers and the many difficulties they face. Applying for asylum is much different than applying for refugee status in America. Kavita Sarana is a senior reporting fellow at ProPublica, and she explains.
There are different legal terms for people who are essentially facing the same thing. They're both people who are trying to escape some kind of violence or persecution in their home country. Refugees is the term for people who've been vetted by the United Nations, usually in a refugee camp abroad, and then they're brought to a country willing to accept them, like the United States or Canada, in a resettlement program. Asylum seekers is the term for people who enter a country and then request to stay on the ground. So a lot of times it's people who feel like they have to get out as fast as possible. For example, in Central America, there's not refugee camps the way there are around the Middle East near Syria, where Syrians have been able to go. So if you're a Central American and you need to escape, you would go towards the United States and try to request asylum there.
And that's just what Adafe Okporo did. He was an AIDS activist in his home country of Nigeria and was part of the LGBTQ community there. On October 28, 2016, just weeks before the election of President Donald Trump, Adafe landed at Terminal 4 at JFK Airport in New York and officially sought asylum.
In 2016, I was living in Nigeria. I was attacked by homophobic community members in my community who felt like I was advocating against their religious views and beliefs. I flew to Cairo. I was staying in Cairo. Then I decided to come to the U.S. because I had a U.S. visa and I know that United States provide protection for asylum seekers. When I came to JFK, I went to Terminal 4, picked up my bag, but I don't have anywhere to go. I've never been to the U.S. before. I don't have friends or family in the U.S. I went to the immigration officer and told the immigration officer, I'm coming from Nigeria, and he asked me to wait for an interview. So he told me that I was going to do a credible fear interview to determine if I would see a judge or if I would be returned back to Nigeria. Asking you questions that will nail you down and lead to you being deported is like their goal. I was taken to a cell. I was kept in the cell in JFK for about 4 hours. They brought me out, put me in chains, threw me in a bus. And the next thing I saw was the detention center. We came in very late in the night. When it dawned on me that I was in a jail-like setting was the next morning after I showered. They gave me a jumpsuit and they took away the clothes I brought. So then I realized that I was going to be having a new home for an unknown period of time.
About 180,000 people applied for asylum in 2016, and the vast majority of them, like Adafe, are detained. Just 4% get parole, meaning they're allowed to live freely while they wait for a decision from the government. But it wasn't always this way. Back in 2011 and 2012, almost everyone who claimed asylum was granted parole. Recently, ProPublica and WNYC teamed up to look at asylum in America. ProPublica's Kavita Sarana explains that over the past few decades, the system designed to make it easier for people seeking safety in the U.S. has instead become backlogged and complicated.
World War II really sparked our current asylum and refugee policy. during the war, a lot of safer countries like the United States largely shut their doors to Jewish refugees. They said it was a national security threat. So after the war, the international community attempted to create a more orderly system to aid people in danger.
Well, Khadija, there's certainly been a lot of reporting around the asylum system. What's the current state of the asylum immigration system in the United States under the Trump administration right now?
I think what we've seen with this administration is an effort to reframe the asylum system as a national security threat, a program that invites loopholes, that is in some way a magnet for people who want to come here illegally instead of just a humanitarian program. There's a really large backlog of asylum cases in immigration court. I think it stands at about 680,000 now, and it takes years to process these. That problem predates the Trump administration, but what we've seen under the Trump administration is a couple things. One is an effort to speed up immigration court hearings and deportations. Another is an effort to detain people while they're waiting for their hearings. The administration says this is because so many people miss their hearings, but advocates and lawyers say that this is also an effort to deter asylum seekers, to make it so difficult to wait and apply for asylum that people will give up. Another thing we've seen is also just an effort to narrow the definition of one category of refugee status called particular social group. This has always been the kind of broadest category that someone could apply for asylum under. And it seems that there's an effort to narrow that even further so that it wouldn't apply to people who are fleeing gang violence from Central America or domestic violence or gender-based violence.
If you're applying today, if you come to the border claiming asylum status, what are you saying to the U.S. government, and how long are you likely to wait until your claim gets processed?
If you come to the border, you have to express a credible fear. You go through what's called a credible fear interview with a U.S. asylum officer, and they'll ask you some basic questions about what you're afraid of. And it's supposed to be a low bar because that is not your full asylum interview. It is just a, are you afraid of something in your home country? Yes, okay, kind of interview. So if you pass the credible fear interview, then there's some exceptions to this. But right now under the Trump administration, you're most likely held in detention until your case comes up in court. It can be from months to years.
So the Trump administration, as you mentioned, Khadija, says that the asylum system is basically rife with abuse, a loophole way to get into the United States. Is there any evidence that people do, in fact, abuse the system as a way to gain entry?
Like any complicated system, the asylum system does have some loopholes, but we don't have hard numbers on how often it happens. And for most people who work in this system on a daily basis, from former ICE prosecutors to former Border Patrol agents, they all said that most people who apply for asylum do so in good faith and believe that they are fleeing danger, even if they don't fit particularly into the asylum laws.
Now, a lot of immigration advocates, you say, are looking to reform this system. How do they want it reformed? And is that likely to happen with the Trump administration basically going in the opposite direction here?
It's very unlikely to happen. I asked a lot of people who've worked in the system for years or decades what they'd like to see changed. And what came up over and over again was, for example, legal representation. Asylum seekers do have the right to seek legal representation, but they don't have the right to a lawyer. A lot of experts said that providing more access to legal counsel would greatly improve the quality of cases, make sure that people who are facing life or death cases in immigration court do receive due process. And studies have also shown that asylum seekers who are working with a lawyer are much more likely to show up for their court date, so it would also cut down on people who apply for asylum but end up not showing up.
Khadija Serrana, Senior Reporting Fellow at ProPublica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So let's go back to Adafe Okporo now. After arriving at JFK from his home, Nigeria, he was put in the Elizabeth Detention Center. It's a privately run facility in New Jersey. Unlike most asylum seekers, Adafe was able to get a lawyer a few weeks into his detention, but he was still denied parole under the Trump administration's more stringent rules. Adafe ended up staying in that detention center for 6 months.
It is very difficult to get asylum. First of all, getting to the U.S. border is very, very difficult. And when you get to the U.S. border, the border patrol officers try to cajole you to sign for your deportation. The process of getting asylum has become more difficult each and every day because they require you to prove that you have a past persecution, you have a present persecution, and you have a future persecution. How can you prove that you are gay before a court of law? It's like making you feel psychologically as if you are crazy. Coming to the US and being re-traumatized by having to narrate all these things at every single process you are faced before an immigration person is just ridiculous for you to prove that you are going through persecution. And now the reasons why people flee from their country is increasing every single day. Who loves to leave his country for any reason? Me, as a person, I don't like to leave Nigeria. I grew up speaking a language, the kind of food I like to eat. I lost all these things to come to America. I was just looking for safety. Staying in a detention center is very tough because everybody who stays in the detention center are depressed. They have anxiety. The detention center is just like a cage. I feel like the detention center is created in such a way now that demoralizes people and make them feel like signing their deportation to go back to their country. But I feel very privileged that I was able to get an immigration attorney because the government does not provide attorneys for asylum seekers because we are not yet US citizens. And I won my case because of articles I have online about me that show the work I do. And I have a representative who stood as a witness for me from USAID. That same day I won my case, I was released that same day, but I was released 10 p.m. in the night. There is nothing like a procedure for someone who was caught in New York and is released in New Jersey that says there's a train station here, or you can make a free phone call for your family member or somebody to come and pick you. They just open the door and say, go. At 10 p.m. in the night, I came from West Africa. We always wear warm clothes, and it's spring. It's still cold for me. To release me at that period of time and say, just walk away, they could have done better. But I'm glad that I was connected to First Friend, a nonprofit who supports people who are detained, to send somebody to come and pick me up that night and take me to a shelter. I would have been homeless. I would have been walking on the streets, displaced. So it's like from one form of trauma to another form of trauma, and we can't continue to remain silent. I worked in the detention center 4 hours every day for $1. I had to do it because I came without money, and I had to communicate with people so I could get documents in the detention center to my lawyers. So for me, if I would advise for a better and just immigration system, countries like Canada, they practice this immigration system. They are housing shelters. So you come and report to immigration. It's better than keeping people in a detention center because keeping people in detention center affects their mental ability to like reintegrate into the society. It's like someone who has been into a jail and come out from jail. You can either be positive or negative, but you're likely to be negative because of the way you are treated. The system is not as glorious as is seen in the movies.
Adafe is 28 years old now. He's been living legally in the United States as an asylee for just over a year, since April of 2017. He's now a volunteer with First Friends of New Jersey and New York, the very same organization that helped him out of immigration detention. But what happens once asylum is granted? Adafe Okporo described being released from detention at night into a strange place where he'd never been before. WNYC reporter Matt Katz learned that in that way, Adafe's story is not unusual.
You're granted asylum, but you're then just released. And I've spoken to many detainees, particularly in the New Jersey area, former detainees, and they say they're released at night. They're not given a list of social service agencies. They're not even given a list of homeless shelters because often they have no money at all. So they're left to kind of wander the streets at times looking for a place to even stay.
You said people are released at night. Does that mean that once asylum is granted, somebody might slide a cell door open or open a door at an ICE office and say, okay, out you go, and you just go out onto the sidewalk and that's it?
Yeah, that's exactly the way people describe it. I mean, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is in charge of detaining people, says if somebody is released from detention, including these new asylees, there are arrangements made with their families, sponsors, or lawyers. But sometimes they don't have any of those things. Sometimes they don't speak English or even Spanish, and they know nobody. So they are kind of left off on their own. I've heard cases of people walking 6-7 miles to find a homeless shelter. I heard about a woman who tried to go back into the detention center in order to sleep because she didn't know where else to go. Now, in the Elizabeth Detention Center, which is a privately run facility in New Jersey, there's a nonprofit organization called First Friends, and they have posted flyers in the detention center with their phone number so people can then call them to make arrangements about a place to go. And this group has actually started a home where they will come and pick up asylees and take them to a place called the Lighthouse. I spoke to a woman, her name is Jill Singleton. She's a church deacon in New Jersey, and she was visiting detainees at the Elizabeth Detention Center, and this is how she got the idea to create the Lighthouse.
I met a man by the name of Peter, and Peter told me that he was being released that evening. And I asked him where he was going to go, and he said he had no idea. And it just absolutely haunted me to think that he had gone through everything that he went through, was put in detention, finally got out, and on the day he was getting out, he had no idea where he was going to go, and he didn't know another living soul in the United States.
Matt, what do people like Peter say about the feeling they get or the disorientation they feel at this moment when they're granted asylum, maybe safe from persecution at home, but then turned loose on their own in a strange place?
It's so disorienting. I met an Ethiopian man. His name is Mesfen Juan Magegnu. He wrote an article against the Ethiopian government, which prompted the government or some allies of the government to shoot him. He was shot. He was injured. He ended up escaping to one African country, then a second African country, at which point he was able to fly to Brazil. And he made his way all the way from Brazil, all the way up through Central America to the Texas border, at which point he declared asylum, he was detained and shipped to New Jersey, where he spent 6 months. And he didn't know then what to do, but he was finally granted asylum. He called this group, First Friends of New York and New Jersey. They have this facility, the Lighthouse in Jersey City, that's been open for about a year now, and that houses asylees, new asylees. And he just extolled the virtues of this organization and this house to me. He said otherwise he would have had no place to go.
How do you live it without first friends? If you don't have family, if you don't have a friend, how do you live? So difficult.
Matt, I'm appreciative of Mesfin's thoughts there and his feelings of isolation if he was turned out by himself. But this is more than just people's feelings of disorientation. I mean, people who are granted asylum and then are left with nowhere else to go are people on the margins. I mean, they might be at real risk.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, there are resources available to them. They are allowed to access welfare. There's small cash payments that they can get for 8 months, but they don't know that these resources are even available to them. I mean, these people have this long journey, and then they literally could end up on the streets.
Matt, what has ICE said about this or other immigration authorities who could improve services for people who are granted asylum?
ICE says that they follow proper procedures and that those detainees are released to their lawyers or to their sponsors or to relatives. They did not address specific complaints about why, at least at facilities in New Jersey, they're released at night when it makes it harder for them to navigate public transportation to get wherever they might go. And also, you know, ICE contracts out a lot of their detention. So finding who's responsible for this can be somewhat difficult.
Now, is anybody talking in a concrete way about maybe just basic information for people who are granted asylum? Hey, you've won your case. Here's where you can go. Here's where you can eat. Here's who you can call.
ICE's official policy says they're supposed to have that written information given to every detainee who is released. They're even supposed to provide winter jackets. I mean, often people are coming from warm climates. They spend 6 months in detention. They end up outside and it's the middle of the winter and they have flip-flops and a windbreaker on. It seems to me it's a matter of ICE following its policy and making sure its contractors are following its policy. And otherwise, it's left up to these nonprofit organizations that have sprung up around the country to help immigrants. And that includes asylees, refugees, and all of these kinds of people. This lighthouse that I visited in Jersey City for recently released asylum seekers, just a small nonprofit and some religious organizations. I went there on the 1 year birthday party of the lighthouse. And in that 1 year, the lighthouse had already housed people from 42 different countries. They have on their mantelpiece all the different flags from all the countries. And in that, you see the best of America. You see these volunteers who are just looking to welcome new and would-be Americans. While the government may fail at its job sometimes, there have been other people all over the country who are willing to fill in the gap here and help out these asylum seekers.
Matt Katz, WNYC. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd.
You can find a link to WNYC and ProPublica's multimedia reporting project about asylum in the United States on our website at thetakeaway.org, and they even have an interactive game that puts you in the shoes of an asylum seeker in the United States. Check it out. Paul Ryan surprised the political world earlier this month by announcing that he would step down as Speaker of the House and retire from Congress completely at the end of the current term. Now, one Democrat hoping to flip Paul Ryan's seat from red to blue is ironworker Randy Bryce, known on Twitter as Iron Stash. Bryce has generated a lot of attention from the 1st District in Wisconsin and a lot of interest from Democrats in Washington who control campaign money. Well, Bryce has become something of a national liberal standard bearer as people prepare for 2018, but he still faces the daunting task of winning a congressional district that voted for Donald Trump by 10 points. I spoke to Randy Bryce and asked him about Donald Trump's appeal to the people he's trying to win over in Wisconsin.
Well, the thing is that he paid attention to working people. The reason why his shine is gone now is because he's not a working person and he hasn't followed through with many of the things that he promised. Me, on the other hand, I've spent my entire life in the district struggling along with our neighbors, and I know what we're going through. There's nothing in Washington, D.C. that is harder than what the working people of Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District are going through right now.
What about Donald Trump? I mean, he won the Wisconsin 1st District by 10 points, and that means an awful lot of people in your community voted for him.
Right, they did. And the people that I'm talking to that voted for Donald Trump tell me that they liked his message of draining the swamp. They like the drain the swamp talk, but what he replaced the swamp water with is a lot more toxic.
Look, Democrats, since Donald Trump shocked them and won the presidential election in 2016, they've been moping around, Randy, you know this, desperate to find a way to reach union Democrats, conservative Democrats, manufacturing Democrats in the Midwest. And it seems like Democrats see in you a potential answer to this riddle. Do you see it that way?
I do. And the thing is that over half the members of Congress are millionaires, and we need more working people in, which is why I'm doing it. Donald Trump made a lot of promises when he ran for office. And when I talked to union members and the union that I belong to, Ironworkers Local 8, I asked them, I was like, can you name something that he promised you that, you know, a promise that he's actually kept?
Now, Donald Trump, though, did promise to get tough on China. He promised to get out of NAFTA or renegotiate it. He promised new trade deals to get out of the trade deals that we're in. I think it's safe to say on trade, Donald Trump has pretty much made good on a lot of his promises. And I thought that a lot of union people, especially in the Midwest, liked that get tough on China, get tough on trade deals approach.
I think that going along with the tariffs, there definitely is a potential for that to be useful to help keep jobs here. But when it comes to the tariffs, originally it was going to be everybody's going to be affected by these tariffs. And then he hesitated and somebody mentioned to him that, you know, you didn't think this through fully. Then he took away Canada and Mexico from it. And like a week later, he removed Australia from it. We need a long, thoughtful process, not the shoot from the hip kind of thing that Donald Trump has done. I mean, the carrier jobs that Donald Trump promised that we're going to stay there, they ended up going to Mexico anyways. We're not there yet. You know, I'd love to see him be able to keep one of his promises, but just talking about something isn't actually seeing it happen.
Well, Randy, you've been getting a lot of attention nationally. I watched one of your campaign commercials online. You're standing in front of a crowd, presumably voters, and you say,
this is why we're going to win. This is what separates us from the other side. We care about everybody, and they don't.
What do you mean by that?
I've always been one to think that leadership should bring people together and lift everybody up. I mean, if you just look at the way that Donald Trump was able to be elected president, he did it on a basis of divide and conquer. Being Latino myself, and when I heard him talk about Mexicans coming here, being rapists and murderers, not sending our best, that was very offensive. And to have a man like Donald Trump actively point you out and say, you don't belong here, I had a problem with it.
Now, Randy, you've also come out and said that Congress should abolish ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Yes.
Is that going to be a controversial position in the First District of Wisconsin? What's immigration like where you're from?
Well, it's one of the issues that really got me involved. Initially, it was kind of a radical thought, but then thinking, you know, really, it's not. ICE hasn't been around for that long. And talking to people that have interactions with ICE, they're going around and terrifying people. We're talking about people that, you know, haven't done anything. And especially when we're talking about dreamers, people that were brought here, average age 6 years old, aside from having documentation, by all their means, are Americans. This is the only land that they know. This is where they were raised. And I think it's unconscionable to have somebody, you know, like Donald Trump saying, we're going to tear your families apart.
What about social issues in the Democratic Party? What's the line that you're walking? People in the Wisconsin First want to talk about abortion and LGBTQ rights and some of the other things that Democrats talk about in Washington?
I mean, I'm supportive of social issues. I would consider myself to be progressive. What really is affecting people in the First District after this recent tax scam was passed is how are we going to keep our Social Security, our Medicare, and our Medicaid? Because after giving $1.5 trillion to people that don't need $1.5 trillion, it's the richest people in the country, now we're being told we can't afford to take care of our own working people when we need a hand.
Now let's talk about this race that you might be facing now that Paul Ryan isn't running for re-election. A former Paul Ryan staffer named Brian Steele just got into the race. He announced it over the weekend. And a lot of Republicans seem excited about his prospects. Paul Ryan was polling way ahead of you before he announced his retirement. Now, Brian Steele isn't Paul Ryan, but it is a Republican district. Is this going to be a tight race?
We'll see. I mean, we'll have $3 million where we're at right now. Whoever gets in is going to have a lot of catching up to do. And now as far as Mr. Steele goes, he's a corporate attorney, you know, another Republican that's going to carry the swamp water for the Republican leadership. Whoever does get in, they're going to have a lot of work cut out for them. But again, we're not taking anybody for granted. We're working just as hard, clicking on all cylinders to make sure we finish this race strong.
Well, you might scare some people off. I mean, you're raking in some money, Randy, more than most people at this stage in their political careers. Sometimes outside money can be a liability in a race like yours. People say, well, he's just taking money from outside interests. How do you answer that?
No, without a doubt. Again, I have to say that that's because we're up against Paul Ryan, who is Speaker of the House. And Paul Ryan is known for his prolific fundraising, traveling throughout the country himself, fundraiser after fundraiser, charging $10,000 for a photo with him. Me, on the other hand, you can have your picture taken with me. The charge was a high five, and that fee has been frequently waived. But we're spending time. It had been over 900 days since Paul Ryan faced the voters of the 1st Wisconsin District. And now comparing it to a district recently won by Connor Lamb, that district was won by 20 points by Donald Trump. And his district is seen as a plus 11 R-leaning district. And the 1st District in Wisconsin is a plus 5 R. It's been held by Democrats before Paul Ryan. Barack Obama won it his first time. Senator Baldwin won it as well. So it's a very winnable seat.
Well, Randy, I think I can predict one thing about your race, or at least I'm going to guess. Republicans are going to do what they often do in races like this. They're going to tie you to somebody who's very unpopular in the Democratic Party. They're going to try to tie you to Nancy Pelosi. Do you think Nancy Pelosi is a liability for Democrats like you who are trying to flip a district and get into Congress?
I think it depends on who you're talking to. It's not something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. I'm extremely concerned about making sure that we get another working person in Congress. And once I get there, I definitely would be anxious to see who wants to take the reins of the leadership position.
Now, let's put a pin on that. You're saying that if you get elected to Congress, you are not pledging to support Nancy Pelosi if Democrats win the majority and she's running for speaker again.
Anytime that there's an election in front of me, I take all the candidates. I look to see who's running, first of all, and then weigh them accordingly with interests of not just myself, but it would be the people of the district.
Randy Bryce, known on the internet as Iron Stash, where he rakes in the attention and, more importantly, rakes in the money, running in a Democratic primary to take the seat of Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House, who's not running for re-election in Wisconsin's 1st District. Randy Bryce, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Todd. It was great talking with you.
Well, before Randy Brice has the chance to run against a Republican in November, he'll have to first secure his own party's nomination in the August primary. Tomorrow, we'll talk to Kathy Myers, another Wisconsin Democrat, hoping to win Paul Ryan's seat. President Trump waded into an old debate over the weekend, saying on Twitter he's considering a full pardon for the late heavyweight boxing champion Jack Johnson, who fought in the early 1900s. Now, boxing fans and some politicians have called for a pardon for Jack Johnson for decades. So far, presidents have avoided the subject. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. He talks about Jack Johnson and what a pardon would mean.
In 1908, Jack Johnson became the first black heavyweight champion of the world during a time when most sports in the United States were segregated. And then much more famously in 1910, Jack Johnson beat a fighter named Jim Jeffries, who was held up as, and this is where the phrase comes from, the Great White Hope, who would defeat Johnson and restore the natural order of things of white supremacy during a time when lynchings were common in this country and Jim Crow ruled the land. But Jack Johnson was this incredible symbol of resistance at this time. And it wasn't just for what he did in the ring. He was what was known as a dandy. He dressed the part. He openly consorted with white women, which was a scandal at the time. And he was never shy about telling anybody, from the president of the United States to Booker T. Washington and the black leadership of the day, that they could go straight to H.E. double hockey sticks if they had any problem with how he handled his life. But then in 1913, Jack Johnson was convicted by an all-white jury on Mann Act charges, otherwise known as white slavery charges, for transporting a white sex worker named Lucille Cameron across state lines for immoral purposes. Now, Johnson ended up marrying Cameron several months later, but the United States still pushed this case until Johnson was found guilty. He was forced to flee the country, and then he returned and served jail time. And since his death, which was, I believe, 72 years ago, people have pushed for either a pardon or an exoneration, saying that the charges were trumped up and racist and much more about bringing Jack Johnson low than anything that had to do with breaking the law.
Now, lots of famous politicians in the modern era who are into boxing, including John McCain, including Harry Reid, the former Democratic leader of the Senate, both boxing fans, have pushed for a pardon for Jack Johnson over the last several years. Why haven't they ever gotten it? And what's got these politicians so interested?
Why they've never been able to achieve it? If you ask this of these politicians, they're befuddled. But in some respects, it speaks to the enduring power of Jack Johnson, that, you know, he really did upset, as I would think of it, all the right people. And I mean, you've got to understand, I mean, so many politicians staked their careers on Jack Johnson being brought low. I mean, it wasn't just Jack Johnson. Laws were passed banning boxing films. Laws were passed trying to ban boxing altogether because of Jack Johnson's success and because of violence that broke out after Jack Johnson would win his fights. And much of that violence would involve white lynch mobs attempting to enter black communities and there being a response to that that would leave people dead. And so the history itself is still so vibrant, I mean, and so blood-soaked that you've seen presidents, Democratic and Republican, refuse to touch this issue.
Well, so now America's talking about Jack Johnson once again because President Trump has said on Twitter that he's considering a pardon. You say, though, Dave, it wouldn't be fitting with who Jack Johnson was to get a presidential pardon.
Yeah, well, I believe that no matter who is president, because I think that what makes Jack Johnson so powerful is he's a towering figure of resistance. And the idea that this country would somehow say to Jack Johnson that we forgive you, I mean, when Jack Johnson has really done nothing whatsoever to be forgiven for. And I also think that when we talk about these pardons or these exonerations for people like Jack Johnson, what it does is it says more about the present than it does about the past. And it's as if saying, well, we have this historic wrong in this one incident with regards to racism, and things today are fine and well. Now, that seemed very weak under President Obama, and it seems even more disturbing under a President Trump. And the idea that he would be the person to exonerate Jack Johnson, I mean, my goodness, there are no words for how much Jack Johnson and Donald Trump would have despised each other if they had lived in similar times.
Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine, host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, it's always great to have you.
Thank you, Todd.
Beyoncé is having a moment that, let's face it, seems to be years long. But her performances at the Coachella Music Festival over the last two weekends seem to bring Beyoncé to a whole new level. Even though it started after 1 in the morning Eastern time, Beyoncé's performance on weekend one of Coachella became the most viewed live stream ever on YouTube. The whole show was a tribute to African-American culture, like her rendition of the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. Those performances resonated deeply with Black Americans across the country, including one mother and daughter who haven't always seen eye to eye on Beyoncé.
My name is Hunter Harris, and I am an associate editor at New York Magazine's Vulture.
I'm Yvonne Lewis. I am Hunter's mom.
Mommy, what do you like know about Beyoncé from me?
I know that you love Beyoncé, and I never could understand why. I never got it. We've had very few conversations about Beyoncé. And you have a story about Beyoncé listening to her music when I was taking you to school.
This is the story. Me listening to Beyoncé. I remember Auntie got me Dangerously in Love, and I was sitting in the back seat of the car. You had a Mazda then. And you were like, okay, you can't listen to tracks like 4, 7, and 12 because like those are inappropriate. And I was like, okay, but whatever. That was like the first time I like disobeyed you, I think. So Beyoncé is really important, I think, in our relationship from like how I see us, because I feel like me loving Beyoncé is like me listening to how you and Auntie would talk about Patti LaBelle and Whitney Houston. And like, I just wanted like that kind of version for myself, like a version of like a really like powerful Black woman in media. And like Beyoncé is that person for me. And that's what I think her Coachella set really kind of showed.
Yeah. And one of the things that I was thinking when I have been reading more about Beyoncé, what I realized, Hunter, is that her Coachella performance, that this is bigger than Beyoncé. And just to give you some real perspective, the rest of the Black pioneers loosened the jar for Beyoncé to pop it open. And that's what she did. Her performance, I think, as I reflect back on it, it represents a mix of activism, of perseverance, of timing that was 50 years in the making. She's able to do, as I'm just seeing this play out on the national, international level, she's able to do what politicians can't. She can straddle differences and bring people together, and she's doing it with music.
But I think it's important to say that she's not only doing it with music. I feel like Beyoncé is such a visualist, like with the visual album in 2013, obviously, with Lemonade, and then I think the highest point of that is the Coachella performance, which kind of, it was very cinematic. It was like watching a, a concert film, but it was something more than that. I think Beyoncé is so conscious of like the ways that Black people have been depicted in media and in pop culture, and she's totally usurping those stereotypes, bringing in her Southern heritage, bringing in like this HBCU legacy, bringing in Nina Simone and Lift Every Voice and Sing, and bringing in, you know, marching bands. Like, these are all really Black things that she's performing in real time on, you know, a pretty white, liberal, but still very wealthy environment, which is Coachella.
Yeah. And another thing that you're talking about, the social consciousness, and I see that. That's what I'm learning about Beyoncé and why she's important to you, because she is like a lightning rod to advanced education among Black youth. She pulls them in with her music, but leaves them with a message about how critical education is to elevate this generation to the next level. And you know, maybe some of her fans don't have consistent role models the way you did, Hunter, but Beyonce is doing what she can to help bridge that gap. And I like to think that she no doubt feels an even greater responsibility being a mom now herself. Motherhood should expand our worldview. And part of that is working to empower the least of these and stand with people in their struggles.
I think it's important, too, that Beyonce is a mother so publicly, because a lot of, parenthood changes your art. And we've seen a lot where it's like someone will start a family and then they'll kind of like retreat from public life. But having Blue, having the twins, Sir and Rumi, has only made her even a more powerful entertainer. And I think that was like a really moving part of her Coachella set, is her saying, I was supposed to perform at this concert last year, but I couldn't because I got pregnant. And in that time, I used like the time away to think and dream with these two babies inside me about what this performance could be. And it's, I mean, that just really like was so meaningful and so beautiful. I thought that like motherhood could be this like place of divine inspiration.
Yeah. You know, speaking of motherhood,
this is so ladybird.
I know. So, you know, there's one word, Hunter, that I know I overused when you were
here we go. Sacrifice.
Yes. Sacrifice. That's it. Because I wanted you to know that it was a struggle to send you to private school. But it paid off, though. Look at you now. I mean, do you remember when you got mad at me when I got rid of our little baby Mercedes for a Toyota Camry, which I still drive today? You were upset because you wanted me to still have that car. But I did what I needed to do to help you succeed. And that's what we as parents and as adults are supposed to do in the lives of children. And Beyonce is doing that, too, though, on a much larger scale. She's helping parent and be role models for an entire world of children and helping create in them a strong and fearless work ethic in the process. And that's what I'm starting to appreciate more about Beyonce, is that level of excellence. I mean, not only just excellence, but she goes beyond that. I mean, she owns it. That's what I take away from her.
No, I feel that too. And I just lost my train of thought, but
sacrifice.
But I think it's when you're talking about like excellence, and I think it's important with, you know, the absence of Obama, with how fractured our society is, yes, when it comes to Black people today, to be able to look at Beyonce, the most powerful entertainer working, and for her to so publicly say, as she did in her 2013 or 2012 documentary for HBO, like she said verbatim, I am here because I'm a product of my mother's prayers and my grandmother's prayers and my sister's prayers. And I feel like that is so, like, those are conversations that we've had. But to hear someone talk about that idea of, like, Black legacy and Black femininity on such a public stage and not have to code switch or not have to change it or not have to interpret it for white listeners is really powerful. And I mean, I don't think I told you this before, but whenever I watched Lemonade for the first time, when I was in college, I just got so emotional because it felt like we had a conversation about daddy and you and your divorce in a way that we hadn't ever had, like, personally ourselves. But it's like, oh, it's like everything about how Black women feel devalued in marriage and, you know, in relationships, it just like snapped into perspective. And I understood all the sacrifices that you made that I didn't even see in like deciding to get a divorce.
Right. I'm glad that someone like Beyonce, or someone that you looked up to in a different realm, was able to bring that message. And it just kind of reminds me that, you know, aside from figures like Martin Luther King Jr. and that most Black kids in the 60s had, they only, you know, celebrities and athletes to look up to. And even then, their influence was limited. I grew up, Hunter, watching Diane Carroll and Pam Grier and Esther Rolle and Gladys Knight, Chaka Khan, Patti LaBelle, of course, all strong women. And I, too, had a strong influence. My mom, who was the first in her family to graduate from college, came from Mississippi picking cotton. I had a cousin who was part of the Freedom Riders. So we have a part to play in helping shape this next generation. And you, Hunter, will no doubt do what we couldn't and then we're not able to do. It wasn't that long ago that Black performers still, you know, had to use the back entrance to nightclubs. And now Beyoncé has the number one viewed video on YouTube. And the shift of influence is staggering.
I mean, that's really, now that you're saying that, it's just kind of coming into perspective that not only is Nina Simone, like, you know, one of the foremost performers in Black music and in music, but, I mean, she had to, like, go in back entrances for her performances, and now she's, like, literally being praised on the Coachella stage by Beyoncé. Like, that's so, I mean, that kind of generational shift I feel like is so important, and I love that Beyoncé is so conscious of that and is so insistent on teaching us that, like, she didn't come from nowhere, that she is building upon this legacy, like you said.
Yeah, and I think that this whole shift represents a shift in attitude and power that no one saw coming. Well, I didn't see coming. But each time someone in the public eye takes a stand and makes a mark, it chips away at that wall that we haven't had access to before, from the back of the bus to the forefront of social media. Fractured voices now sing in unison with Beyoncé leading the chorus.
Wow. That's, yeah, no, I completely agree.
And I do have a question for you, Hunter. What has Beyoncé and her performance at Coachella taught you that you might not have gotten any other way?
Oh, that's a good question. One of my favorite moments of the whole set was when I, not to be shady, but when she was performing with Jay-Z, they were doing Deja Vu, and Jay-Z, like, came on stage and, like, forgot some of his rap. Meanwhile, Beyoncé is doing the choreography that she did when they debuted the song on an award show, and, like, did it seamlessly as if it were nothing. And I just love that idea that Beyoncé, this was her goal from the beginning, that this is, like, where you are right now might not be where you always will be, if that makes sense. Like, I just like the idea that Beyoncé has been this powerful of an artist forever, but that she's only now getting the tools to really execute on her vision. And that's so inspiring to me as, like, a young person, that, you know, the things that I want to do, I don't have all the tools for right now, but that doesn't mean that they won't ever get done.
Yeah. You will do it.
Yeah, because you're doing it too.
Yeah. In a different way.
Okay. This is, like, too Lady Bird. So, love you.
Yeah. Okay. Love you.
Okay. Bye.
That's Hunter Harris, an associate editor for New York Magazine's Vulture, talking with her mom, Yvonne Lewis. You can hear their full conversation on our website at thetakeaway.org.
Sometimes these walls seem to cave in on me when I look in your eyes.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.